Isn't it infuriating when you're talking to someone about something you find deeply fascinating and they hit you with the phrase, "It's not that deep"? There has been an awful lot of discussion about this phrase online. To some, it is a helpful reminder meant to reel in our tendency for pointless rumination. And to others, it is a herald of anti-intellectualism and the death of critical thought. And as we'll see, both of these positions have something to them. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. 1. It's not that deep. When I've been observing the discourse around people arguing what is not that deep and what is genuinely that deep, I've noticed that oftentimes we switch between two distinct uses of the phrase, it's not that deep. And this is important to pry apart if we're going to get a clear view of the discussion. Sometimes people apply it's not that deep to our emotions and our behaviour. Say I was getting really het up about some unkind thing someone said to me, well then a friend might tell me it's not that deep, meaning that it's just not worth worrying about. Here, the implicit meaning is that I am letting the comment get to me far more than is appropriate. It's very similar to saying you're blowing this out of proportion. In everyday life, I actually think this may be the more common usage, and it is certainly the one that I hear more in person, though that might be just because I'm a bit dramatic and lots of my friends are. However, I don't think this is the usage that dominates people's discussions about the phrase online. Instead, this more controversial use of it's not that deep focuses on the analysis and interpretation of media, literature, or language. It's like that old meme that went around about the curtains just being blue. It references the supposed tendency of English teachers, and by extension, people who are interested in literature, to read too much into what they're reading, inferring author intention where none is actually there. However, people don't just use this phrase concerning literature. I've seen people say it's not that deep in response to analysing films or media or even news stories. To give an instance of this usage, in my video on Fahrenheit 451 or 451, I drew a comparison between the philosophy of Beatty, the chief fireman, and one interpretation of the philosopher Thomas Hobbes. Someone might respond by saying that it's just not that deep. Chances are, Ray Bradbury did not want to intentionally evoke Hobbesian philosophy in Beatty, and thus I am just reading far too much into the story. Put a pin in this idea of what the author wants to say, as it will become relevant later in the video. So, despite their differences, the thread that runs through both of these uses is that someone is, in some sense, managing to find something where nothing is actually there. They are gazing into a puddle as if it were a deep well. In the case of emotional usage, it is that I am finding something to be upset about when there's nothing actually worth being upset about. And in the literary usage, it's that I am finding supposed depth in the character of Beatty when that was not intended by the author. And so it is not, in that sense, in the story. We'll be focusing on the literary usage in this video, but I just wanted to acknowledge the other sense of the phrase, since they are ultimately quite connected. I spend a lot of time on this channel analysing literature that I love, so it won't surprise you to learn that I ultimately do disagree with most of the time people say it's not that deep. For reasons we'll come onto later in the video, I quite often do think that literature has depths worth plunging into, but at the same time, I am sympathetic to the general urge here. Surely we can agree that sometimes we do read too much into some things, and that these things sometimes include literary texts. So, I've been working for a while now on a long analysis of Cormac McCarthy's novel, Blood Meridian. This is a novel absolutely brimming with symbolism, and you could spend years analysing it and still not uncover all the possible depths it has. And yet, you can still read too much into it. Take the following passage, for example. They rode 5 days through desert and mountain and through dusty pueblos, where the populace turned out to see them, their escorts in varied suits of time-worn finery, the prisoners in rags. They'd been given blankets, and squatting by the desert fires at night, sun-blackened and bony and wrapped in these scrapes, they looked like God's profoundest peons. It would not be reading too much into this to say the phrase God's profoundest peons connects with the Gnostic themes in McCarthy's novel, where dark perversions of religious imagery are continually invoked and employed to make the world seem like a hostile place where the Christian God has no real power, and to really hammer home the sense that the earth is fallen. However, it would clearly be a stretch to say something like the use of the word road uses homophony to subtly reference the novel that McCarthy would write decades later, called The Road. Likewise, if I said the letter T is used 23 times in this passage, corresponding to Psalm 23, where David walks through the shadow of the valley of death, that also seems a bit suspect. Although it is difficult to come up with exact, universally applicable criteria for when we have read too much into a text, it does seem possible to do so. To that extent, the phrase "it's not that deep" or some equivalent does have a place in our conversations around literature. We'll be exploring that idea of criteria for interpretations for the rest of the video. It's going to be one of our key ideas, so do bear that in mind. But before moving on, just because I love literature doesn't mean I think we can't also hone our critical thinking skills in other ways, which is why I recommend you check out today's sponsor, Brilliant. We all know that studying STEM subjects like maths or science or programming can be incredibly difficult. These can get quite unintuitive rather quickly, which often presents challenges for students. But this is where Brilliant is really helpful. They have courses on a wide range of topics, from programming with functions to probability theory to learning the ins and outs of large language models or classical mechanics. And each one is crafted by award-winning research teams. Additionally, Brilliant's learning is based around you doing exercises, so you can learn by putting the ideas that you're imbibing into practice, which both improves retention and just stops things getting boring. It can also reduce your social media doom scrolling, since with their app, you can complete lessons or exercises on the go rather than spending the afternoon getting involved arguing whether something was that deep on some 300-tweet-long Twitter thread. If you want to improve your own critical thinking skills, you should check out the Logic course on Brilliant, which will let you see a bit of what logic is about, and with even a little bit of logic, the world is a whole lot clearer. A friend of mine also gives his personal recommendation to their calculus puzzles. To learn for free on Brilliant, go to brilliant.org/unsolicited advice, or scan the QR code on screen, or click the link in the description. Brilliant's also giving my viewers 20% off an annual premium subscription, so please do check that out. But anyway, back to the video. However, many have criticized the phrase for being anti-intellectual and just generally encouraging a lack of curiosity towards both literature and the world around us more generally. I do think there's something in this. At its worst, the phrase can be used to just dismiss out of hand any attempts to analyze anything for deeper meaning or deeper significance. This is how you end up saying that 1984 is just a fun sci-fi story with no relevance to the real world or lessons it could teach us. Additionally, this attitude could potentially stretch well beyond the world of literature, and we could start to become totally incurious about the world itself. A number of creators have talked about people self-identifying as bimbos and himbos, and how certain proportions of Gen Z have transformed ignorance into a badge of honor, as if curiosity itself were a bad thing. I just don't know how significant of a trend this is, but the phrase "it's not that deep" is sometimes used as this blanket way to dismiss any attempt to put effortful analysis into anything we read, and this is then subtly extended to dismissing the value of critical or effortful thought altogether. To give an example of just such a response, I came across this interesting video by a YouTuber named Celine, who makes the following critiques of "It's Not That Deep," among some others. 1. "It's not that deep" is applied where it is inappropriate to do so, missing the genuine depth within a text. 2. "It's not that deep" discourages people from thinking critically about what they read and watch. And 3. "It's not that deep" is used to dismiss topics or fields rather than explore them or understand them further. Of course, whether the phrase and the trend it represents truly has caused a decline in critical thinking or curiosity is an empirical claim and one that would probably be very hard to test in practice. But it is undeniably plausible, and anecdotes don't count for nothing here, especially when it's very difficult to see how you could measure this at scale and isolate this as a causal factor. And even if we did just consider the impact of this attitude on literature, do we really want to discourage people from closely engaging with the books that they read? On the other hand, when confronted with two opposing sides like this, it's easy to merely set up a binary choice between people who analyse literature and people who only give surface-level readings to books. But I actually think that things are probably a lot more complex than this, and we may actually end up learning something from the it's not that deep camp. And to understand why, I think we have to take a look at the process of interpretation itself. 2. What the hell is interpretation anyway? The question of is it that deep seems fundamentally related to what it means to interpret a text. This is a whole field of philosophy and literary studies, and we can't really go into it in any detail. We'll really just skim the surface of it here. But to begin with, let's just take a look at what kind of things separate the process of literary interpretation from other sorts of inquisitive activity. Why is it that someone can say it's not that deep about literature, but people don't tend to say it about science or mathematics? So take scientific inquiry, for example. When we take our perceptions and then systematize them into a set of natural laws or theories, what is it that we're trying to do? Well, from one perspective, we are trying to find things out about the external world. That is, we are trying to discover what is true about reality. But even taking this as read, how do we know that something is true in this scientific sense? Well, the standard, and I think very plausible answer, is to do with observation and prediction. We test our theories by checking them against our future observations. If the theory does not predict or cohere with our observations of the world, then we set it aside. If it does, we keep it on until something better replaces it. But why does this process work? Well, for many reasons. But one key reason is that we human beings generally observe the same kinds of things in the same kinds of circumstances. If you and I are put in front of the same table and asked to measure it, we will get roughly the same results. They will be convergent. If we get 1,000 people in a room and ask them to observe the same event from the same angle in the same conditions, they will report roughly similar findings, or at least most of them will. This is what allows us to check one another's observations and one another's results in science. If half the world was populated by hyper-intelligent bees who perceive the world in fundamentally different ways to us, then we would find it much more difficult to check the results of one another's experiments. We wouldn't be able to do this cross-person verification process because we would, in effect, have two rival non-convergent models of the world. Whether or not you think that science is uncovering metaphysical truth or just accounting for cumulative observations, the whole enterprise can only pragmatically function because we humans perceive roughly the same things in roughly the same situation. Now, don't be fooled into thinking this is in any way a more profound point than it actually is. I'm just pointing out that in order to predict observations and to communicate those predictions between people, those people have to observe things in roughly the same way. Luckily, this does largely hold for our perceptual observations of the natural world. As C.S. Pierce pointed out, we can't choose what we perceive. Our perceptions are forced on us, largely independent of what we want. I am simplifying here, but to illustrate this point, if I stick my hand in a fire, it is not up to me whether I perceive it as hot. Of course, this doesn't mean that our perceptions are not value-laden or not conceptually influenced, just that they are stable enough for the purposes of scientific inquiry, and importantly, convergent enough. All of this helps underpin the stability of scientific observation and scientific theorizing. It's part of what allows us to make progress in this type of inquiry. It also means it is difficult to read too much into observational scientific statements, because they have this helpful convergent property, and thus we can agree about observations. It's worth noting that when we do lose this connection with convergent observations, we do start to see people make it's not that deep-esque statements about scientific theories. For instance, the quantum physicist Arthur Sommerfeld used to warn his students away from thinking about what quantum physics means and whether it is true and what different parts of quantum physical mathematics refers to. He instead wanted them to stick to looking at the results of experiments and how to predict those results. In effect, he was saying that the metaphysical interpretations of quantum mechanics were not that deep because they go beyond what we can have convergent observations about. But what does any of this have to do with literature? Well, one thing that separates interpretations of literature from most scientific inquiry is just how much variation there can be in how we interpret a text. Take something like The Great Gatsby, for example. Two people can read this novel and come away with very different interpretations of it. One person latches onto the connection between money and status. Another thinks of it as a sort of twisted, corrupt love story. Another views it as a commentary on the American dream. A fourth person simply takes in the plot and doesn't think to look beneath the surface. And each of these readers ends up with a very different picture of what The Great Gatsby is about, and there's no immediately obvious way of adjudicating between them. We can't run an experiment on the text in the same way that we can measure my table. This leads to a situation where one person can genuinely not see the same depth another person sees in a piece of literature, with no immediately obvious way to resolve that disagreement. This is also complicated by the fact that interpreting a text involves a lot of input from the reader. Interpretations are not always obvious from just looking at the literal meaning of a book, especially in more symbolically heavy books like Blood Meridian. And this opens the door for us to potentially project meaning onto a text that is not, intuitively speaking, in the text. It's always very difficult to tell just how much of an interpretation comes from the book and how much comes from the reader, and it's highly questionable whether there is even a neat line between where the meaning of the book ends and the meaning created by the readers begins. After all, if there were no readers, the book would cease to have any meaning at all. If every single English speaker and reader died, and all trace of the language was thus wiped from existence, what would be the meaning of Hamlet, or even of a basic English sentence like "the cat is on the mat"? Language and linguistic interpretation is always a collaboration between speaker and hearer, and is even more so in the case of a novel. And as we've just seen, the interpretations can vary much more than the way we interpret reality when we go about our scientific theorizing. This interdependence between the text and the reader means that whether someone is reading too much into something is always going to have a bit of a fuzzy boundary. However, it's worth noting that a fuzzy boundary is not no boundary. We don't have a neat criterion that can tell us when grains of sand become a heap or when stubble becomes a beard, but there are still clear instances of heaps and beards in the world. What it seems we need is something like an evaluation criteria for interpretations of literature. This is notoriously difficult to do, and you could fill libraries with works simply debating what makes a good or bad interpretation of a given book or books themselves. We will explore what these criteria might be in the next section, but here I just want to show the importance of having such a criteria at all. It's also worth noting that I'm not enormously familiar with the literature around hermeneutics here, so I am largely shooting from the hip, as it were. When I have asked people why they agree with the "curtains are just blue" meme, or why they think it's just not that deep regarding literature, they normally say something like this. The trouble is that in interpretation, anything goes. You might say that the curtains are blue because of something about the character's mental state. I say it's just because they are blue. Who can say whether you are right or I am right? So there's no point talking about it. And I actually do think this argument is getting at something important, which is that without any notion of what makes a good or bad interpretation, the whole exercise of interpretation seems a little bit idle. There's nothing stopping me from making up some deeper meaning and then just assigning it to the text. No one can say anyone is wrong about anything, and so we may as well just be doing word association. The significance of a dialogue partly comes in specifically what you cannot say, what the criteria for admissibility are. Scientific communication takes its significance partly from the fact that there are empirical criteria for what makes a good or bad scientific theory, and thus what makes an admissible scientific statement. Mathematical communication, however seemingly impractical or abstract, still does have to pass an incredibly high bar to be admitted into the world of mathematical facts. I think sometimes, when someone expresses extreme skepticism about interpretation or its value, they are often pointing to a perceived lack of evaluative criteria for what makes an interpretation worth listening to or worth believing in. And if no criteria is provided, there is a real sense in which the whole process of interpretation does seem uninformative. If you can say anything, then you end up saying nothing. It reminds me of an article by cognitive psychologist and friend of the channel, Dr. Shane Littrell, called "The Death of Expertise Was an Assisted Suicide," and you can read it here. There, he argues that increasing distrust in accredited expertise has been partly fueled by experts themselves beginning to believe that they can comment on anything and everything with the presumed authority of an expert on it. And so we slowly began to lower our trust in what experts say. This too is a reflection of looser evaluative criteria. If you can proclaim to be an expert while still spewing a lot of bollocks, and if you can be an expert on one thing and then proclaim yourself an expert on everything, then the label expert carries a lot less weight. That is, if everyone's an expert, then no one can be. I call it the syndrome thesis of evaluation, after the villain from The Incredibles who wanted to make everyone super, because if everyone's super, then no one is. This is why I'm hesitant to respond to "it's not that deep" by just saying it is that deep. While I think that the anti-deep brigade can definitely dip into anti-intellectualism, I also think it is equally anti-intellectual to argue that things are always that deep, and thus to allow for a totally unconstrained range of interpretations, each equally as good as one another. This attitude, in my view, is just as destructive to literary interpretation as a discipline, because it ultimately trivializes the exercise. It would be as if someone responded to science denial by throwing out any empirical standards in science. It's not so simple as every interpretation is in and of itself good, because, if anything, this would genuinely justify someone thinking that literary interpretation was pointless. It would make it analogous to playing football without any goalposts. So, if it is a perceived lack of evaluative criteria that is behind the "it's not that deep" crowd, what kinds of criteria could we offer? If you want to help me make more videos like this, then please consider subscribing, either to the channel, or if you're feeling incredibly generous and want to gain access to exclusive content, including my slow motion book by book bookshelf tour, then consider subscribing to the Patreon, though it's absolutely no pressure. The links are in the description. 3. So, are the curtains just blue? One of the oldest observations in philosophy comes from Aristotle, who said that if you want to call something good or bad, then you need to know what it's for. A sharp knife is a good knife because a knife's purpose is cutting. A waterproof umbrella is better than one with loads of holes in it because an umbrella's job is to keep out the rain. You don't need to buy into some heavyweight Aristotelian notion of purpose to use this style of reasoning, especially when it comes to specifically human activities. A good football player is someone who is fast, with good ball control, good shot accuracy, etc., 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 because those are the kind of things that make you more likely to achieve the explicit aim of football, to win the game. So we can ask ourselves, what is the aim of interpreting a piece of literature? And I would argue, there is certainly not just one aim. The word interpretation hides a multiplicity of subtly different activities with quite different intentions in mind that will then naturally give birth to different evaluative criteria. Here are some of what I think are the more common aims that I see when I'm watching people interpret literature. Perhaps what many people think of when it comes to literary interpretation is that we're trying to reconstruct the intention of the author. This goal is implicit in the meme about the curtains just being blue from earlier. The contrast is drawn between what the teacher thinks the author intended versus what the author actually intended, because the person who created this meme thinks, either consciously or unconsciously, that the goal of interpretation is to get at what the author actually meant by something. This does make a lot of sense as an aim of interpreting literature. After all, when we communicate with one another in a much more everyday sense, we are often trying to transmit thoughts from one mind to another. And in as much as this is true, when we're listening to someone in person in our everyday lives, we are trying to get at the intended meaning behind their speech. This is what cognitive linguists sometimes call the speaker meaning of an utterance. And as a result, the evaluative criteria for this aim seems pretty intuitive. The criteria being, is our analysis or interpretation in line with what we know about the author, and what we can glean about the author's intention from the text itself. Take Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. It is pretty uncontroversial to interpret this as a critique of economic inequality in the early to mid-20th century United States. And this was almost certainly part of Steinbeck's intended meaning for the text, specifically around the Great Depression. The book pulls absolutely no punches in showing the most demoralizing and heart-wrenching aspects of economic deprivation, and it doesn't shy away from demonstrating the heartlessness of bureaucratic banking institutions that oftentimes cause that deprivation. He also said this in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech. Literature was not promulgated by a pale and emasculated critical priesthood singing their litanies in empty churches, nor is it a game for the cloistered elect, the tin-horn mendicants of low-calorie despair. So, it's fair to say that problems of economic inequality and its relationship to literature were on Steinbeck's mind. This kind of interpretation is also prominently used when interpreting scripture, because a lot of believers are, understandably, highly invested in what God intended with the holy text in question. This type of interpretation can also go well beyond the explicit or conscious aims of the author, and we can begin to talk about the unconscious assumptions that they're using as well. For example, Shakespeare has Hamlet say the following: "But that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose burn no traveller returns, puzzles the will, and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of. Thus conscience does make cowards of us all." Separate from exactly what Shakespeare explicitly meant to communicate with this section, we could identify a series of assumptions that he is making. For example, that there is such a thing as a will, and that cowardice is a bad or undesirable thing. Here, again, the evaluation criteria is based on the factual plausibility of the argument with reference to the kind of implicit things we would expect to be in the mind of a man living in Elizabethan England and from the evidence expressed in the text. That is it plausible that Shakespeare believed that cowardice was a bad thing? Well, probably. And the irony inherent in the final phrase of that section relies on the contrast between conscience, assumed to be a good thing, and cowardice, assumed to be a bad thing. However, this process of attempting to reconstruct the author's mind is certainly not the only aim that people themselves have in mind when they are interpreting literature. You might, for example, be partly concerned with fidelity to authorial intent, but also be highly interested in something else. Although this example is from philosophy, not literature, I'm reminded of how John Richardson opens his book on Nietzsche's philosophy, entitled Nietzsche's System. "Since I often push for specificity beyond what can be found in Nietzsche's words, the system this book sketches is, in its details at least, a construction on and beyond what he says, and an effort to use, to think productively with, the ideas he leaves us. The boundary between these points of describing and developing is, inevitably, very hard to draw. But I propose that the main lines of what follows do match the deep structure of his thought." That is, Richardson is not just trying to say what Nietzsche's intentions were and what Nietzsche meant by his words when he put pen to paper. He's not just trying to elucidate what Nietzsche, as expressing Nietzschean philosophy, means. He is balancing the twin aims of faithfulness and fruitfulness to be part constructive and part conservative in his reading of Nietzsche. Thus, our evaluation criteria can't just be to check Richardson's claims against the historical evidence we might have for Nietzsche's intentions, since Richardson freely admits that that is not his only goal. His stated goal is also to systematize Nietzsche's thought, even where this might go beyond Nietzsche's own intentions. Thus, we must partly evaluate Richardson's claims against the fruitfulness, cogency, and coherence of the ultimate philosophical system that he, almost collaborating with Nietzsche's works, creates. The mixed nature of Richardson's stated aims must be reflected in the criteria that we use to evaluate it. And an awful lot of interpretation sort of implicitly falls into this second camp, where the interpreter is partly invested in authorial intent, but they are just as interested in using this piece of work for some other aim. René Girard is possibly one of the most famous interpreters of thinkers like Dostoevsky, Stendhal, and Proust. Yet, If you read his writings on these authors, he is often more interested in what they reveal about mimetic desire through their writings than in just working out what specifically these specific authors were trying to communicate, what they had in mind when writing. A lot of the interpretation that I do on this channel also falls into this camp. Did Bradbury mean for Beatty to tell us something about the Hobbesian attitude in political philosophy? Well, probably not. But does the attitude of Beatty serve as a good example of the focus on avoiding civil war and civil strife that often influences Hobbes's writings? Well, I would argue that it does, and that acknowledging this makes the experience of reading Fahrenheit 451 that bit richer. A lot of authors actively encourage this constructive aspect to interpretation. For example, Ursula K. Le Guin argues that the endless potential for meaning construction across different readers was what made for great poetry and great poetic fiction. Additionally, you might aim to simply use a given text as a loose jumping-off point for what is primarily your own independent thinking, and thus be largely unconcerned about the official authorial intent. For example, here is a section from Byung-Chul Han's The Burnout Society where he discusses a short book by Kafka. A very cryptic tale, Prometheus. Kafka undertakes a few modifications of the Greek legend. His reworking reads, "The gods grew weary. The eagles grew weary. The wound closed wearily." I would subject Kafka's version to further revision and turn it into an intrapsychic scene. The contemporary achievement subject inflicting violence on and waging war with itself. As everyone knows, Prometheus also brought work to mankind when he gave mortals the gift of fire. Today's achievement subject deems itself free when in fact it is bound like Prometheus. The eagle that consumes an ever-regrowing liver can be interpreted as the subject's alter ego. Viewed in this way, the relation between Prometheus and the eagle represents a relation of self-exploitation. Pain of the liver, an organ that cannot actually experience pain, is said to be tiredness. Prometheus, the subject of self-exploitation, has been seized by overwhelming fatigue. Here, Han does not primarily concern himself with what Kafka's intentions with the story were. In fact, he doesn't really concern himself with it at all. He is using it as an illustrative example and almost an inspiration for his own thoughts about the achievement society and the achievement subject. It is almost totally irrelevant to Han's point whether Kafka himself would have intended his story to be read in this way. This style of interpretation is just far less closely connected with the text, but it does still have evaluative criteria. It's still not a total free-for-all. We can ask questions like, how well does the story actually illustrate the point Han is making? Does it illuminate his thought further or obscure it? How good are the thoughts that are sparked in Han by this story? There are many, many more uses for interpretation that we could talk about. We could discuss St. John Henry Newman's point that engaging with literature helps fill out your character. Here, interpretation is as much an ethical endeavor as it is an aesthetic or literary one. Some interpret literature as a way to reveal enduring observations about human psychology and the human condition, or even so-called eternal truths. The list could go on and on, but in each case, having a clear aim also gives us a clue as to what the criteria of evaluation ought to be in each act of interpretation. With this in mind, we can see how "it's not that deep" might be best applied. Something is plausibly not that deep when the interpretation goes far beyond what is permissible to say given its aims and thus its evaluative criteria. So if someone genuinely is trying to get at an author's intention and they make a tenuous argument about what that intention might be, then we can genuinely say they might be reading too much into something, and so it genuinely might not be that deep. On the other hand, it makes no sense to respond to Han's interpretation of Kafka's story by saying, "That's not what Kafka had in mind. He didn't even know the difference between the achievement subject and the obedience subject." I think a lot of the time, "it's not that deep" is used and misused when someone evaluates an interpretation by the wrong criteria. If someone is just not aiming at authorial fidelity, then questioning whether the interpretation represents authorial intent is not a great critique. It would be worth using some other evaluative criteria that better reflects the aims of the interpreter. However, it doesn't help that it's often difficult to work out what exactly the aim of a given act of interpretation is. And interpreters do often swap back and forth between aims within the same interpretation or even within the same essay. I am certainly guilty of this. In my video on 1984, there were some parts, such as the emphasis on the importance of memory and on the terror of surveillance, that were directly informed by Orwell's stated intent with the novel. But there were other parts, like my interpretation of O'Brien as wishing to give up his individuality partly in order to avoid a fear of weakness and death and come closer to something like a platonic form, that were much less interested in whatever Orwell had in mind when writing this story, and were more interested in crafting a lens through which the book becomes richer and more interesting than without it. Was I reading too much into it? Was it that deep? Well, according to one aim, yes. But according to another aim, no. But don't get me wrong, I'm not letting the it's not that deep crowd totally off the hook. Sometimes people advancing the anti-deep position go well beyond simply assuming that the aim of interpretation in a given instance is to discover authorial intent, and into saying that discovering authorial intent is the only worthwhile type and aim of interpretation, as if all of these other aims that we've been talking about are totally pointless. And this is where I really must push back. As we've already illustrated, there is so much more potential in interpreting literature than just this. Think back to the best novel that you've ever read. I would imagine that the engagement was not just trying to unpack what the author meant. If I were to hazard a guess, I would think that it involved a kind of wrestling, for lack of a better word. The author's thoughts melded with your own and battled it out until it was difficult to tell where theirs ended and yours began. And in this wrestling process, you probably had thoughts that you wouldn't have had without the book, but were not entirely in the book either. Whatever value, enjoyment, or meaning that you got out of the text was partly your own creation building on the author. The assumption that all interpretation is trying to uncover the author's intention implies that this wrestling is bad or pointless or undesirable, when I think it's probably one of the most valuable and meaningful parts of reading. I've talked a lot on the channel recently about the concept of depth, and in a prior video, we concluded that part of what makes something deep is the perception that it is inexhaustible, or at the very least, difficult to exhaust. A deep novel is deep because it seems like you could read it over and over again and have new and exciting thoughts each and every time. But, of course, if all we're trying to do is work out what the author themselves wanted to say, the meaning must be exhaustible. The author would have had a finite number of intended meanings for each sentence because the human mind has a finite capacity. But then, where does this sense of inexhaustibility, of depth, come from? Well, I would argue it comes from the ability a good book has to pull you into a conversation with itself. It is in the wrestling that we find all of the parts of the novel that seem like they would apply almost uniquely to us. We highlight the aspects that reflect our own intellectual and emotional idiosyncrasies. Way back in late 2023, when I must have had like 2,000 subscribers, I said this about Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, and please forgive the audio quality. No one can read Crime and Punishment without learning more about themselves than they bargained for, and this is probably why it is still considered to be one of the greatest novels of all time. The way that each of us can read a truly great book, or any truly brilliant piece of literature, and come away with different interpretations can initially seem like it is a disadvantage of literature. And yeah, it is. So long as we are stuck thinking that it is our job as readers to just work out precisely what the author had in mind with each and every line. While I do think that this conception has its place, I think that if we limit ourselves to it, it demeans our role as readers. It relegates us to the status of passive vessel, there to just receive something from the page. Does it not do so much more justice to the act of reading and interpreting to recognize the variable and human aspects to it? To recognize that it is not just a passive process, but an active engagement, an active wrestling with a great mind who may have lived in years gone by, but that we can somehow miraculously converse with in the present day? So, yes, The English teacher may be reading too much into things when they declare some grand authorial intent behind the curtains being blue. Though, to be clear, they might not be. Many authors do put a lot of symbolism into their setting descriptions. However, reconstructing authorial intent is not the only or even the main goal behind people interpreting literature. And sure, this might not matter much when it comes to poking a bit of fun at English teachers. Who hasn't done that in secondary school? But if this joke becomes internalized and accepted as proof that interpreting literature is just the domain of the fool, the ivory tower intellectual, or those suffering from artistic diarrhea, then we do something far worse than just disrupt a Year 11 English lesson. We deprive ourselves of a way of engaging with literature. And that, I think, is a far more serious crime. Think back to the best novel that you ever read, the one that sticks with you the most. Imagine if you've been totally discouraged from analysing it, from engaging with it, from picking it apart and conversing with it. Imagine that you hadn't given it your full attention, but that you'd skimmed it for its main plot points and then thrown it aside. Would it have still had the same impact? I am willing to bet that it wouldn't. That is just what we're doing when we think of interpretation as only limited to working out what the author meant. We lose the ability to let a work become part of you by putting a part of yourself into your reading of it. And once we've lost this ability, will it be easy to get it back? Or will it just fade from view as even a possibility until the idea of enriching your experience of the world through literature becomes something unthinkable, a kind of alien methodology that just never enters back into our awareness, as lost as the semi-mythical memories of those who passed down Homer's oral poetry for hundreds of years, or the teleologically infused standpoint of the wandering desert fathers who saw the whole world through the lens of their faith at every second of every day. I am anxious that we do not lose sight of the value of interpretation, because once it drifts out of view, I think we may forget to look for it again. And if you need convincing that that would be a loss, let me implore you again to recall your favourite book. But if you do want to see more on the value of literature, then please check out this video where I give a pretty no-nonsense argument for why I think that you should read novels. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.